Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with...
Frida Liu.
Arvind Yuvaraj.
Oh, you're back then.
Oh, yeah. I didn't go anywhere.
You didn't go anywhere. We saw your Instagram.
He was hard at work.
I'm sure the listeners at home also saw your Instagram and got ever so slightly jealous of you. What were you doing in Phuket?
Working, yeah.
What were you doing exactly?
A lot of interviews, a lot of business correspondence. No, I was actually there for the Kaspersky weekend conference. So they had they brought together a bunch of speakers to talk about cyber espionage and cyber security, and then give us updates. They do this once a year. They do it annually. And this year it was in Phuket. Very well organized. And I was able to get three interviews with three different speakers on... what's happening in cybersecurity and how hackers have actually grown to become literally into gangs that hack into banks and other things and all that.
But I mean, there's been an awful lot of kind of controversy around Kaspersky themselves, right, in fairly recent years.
It is, and they also addressed that. And they also, they said that there's no reason for them to be politically affiliated.
Right.
You know, so it's basically just the US at this point who don't want to have anything to do with them.
Right.
Or maybe authorities in the US.
Right.
Yeah. But otherwise, if you listen to the stuff that they do, and the people that they have on board, some of them work with Interpol as well, and how they're trying to counter all these cyber attacks, it's pretty interesting stuff. I think this week I'll have a couple of snippets ready that we can play of some of the things that they said during the conference.
Maybe on Thursday when it's Tech Thursday.
Yep. Yes, yep. Looking forward to hearing it. Okay, folks, if you want to get in touch with the show today, get us on Twitter. We are at BFM Radio, and of course, we're also on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. Stories coming up today, something called Author Orthorexia, which Arvind will be tackling. Frida will be tackling extreme experiments for kids, how to get them off of that phone.
It's very personal to me.
Yeah, we're looking at an idea of smart investing or robo-investing and whether or not that's a good thing to be doing. And then finishing up with responsive cities and some events that you might want to check out this week.
Mm-hmm.
Right then, explain to me what orthorexia is. I mean, it's something that it sounds like something I'd normally hear on The Bigger Picture.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's also something I've heard the phrase kind of been thrown up a little bit. Thrown up, perhaps not the best choice of words.
Yeah.
Explain to me then, Arvind, please.
Yeah. So this is it's a weird story because it's a bit of a paradox, because some experts are saying that an obsession with healthy eating may actually be endangering lives.
Okay.
So someone's obsession with their diets may actually be putting them in a lot of danger. The story, they focused on, and this is a piece that came out of The Star. So they focused on Sabrina Debusquat. I think I'm saying that right.
Yep.
She's 29. And then over 18 months, she became a vegetarian, then a vegan. So she was avoiding eggs and dairy products and even honey. And then she became a raw foodist who avoided all kinds of cooked food. And then finally, she just decided to become a fruitist. I think she just started
fruitarian.
Eating fruits.
Fruitarian.
Fruitarian, yeah. So she just started eating fruits.
Because the next step is breathing.
Yeah, just air. So what happened was her boyfriend was very worried, and then he found clumps of hair in the bathroom sink.
Oh, wow.
And only after he confronted her and showed her the proof that something is really wrong with her health, and then she started to realize that she was sliding and that her health was suffering. So what some specialists call this, they say that it's a modern eating disorder called orthorexia nervosa. It's about someone suffering from orthorexia is imprisoned by a range of rules which they impose on themselves. These very strict self-enforced laws isolate the individual from social food gatherings, and in extreme cases can also endanger their health. And it's when enthusiasm becomes pathological obsession, which leads to social isolation, psychological disturbance, and even physical harm.
Do we know what kind of what causes it or kind of gets this idea in their head?
They say that it's more of a phobia than an actual disease. That's the thing, because this orthorexia is not recognized as a disease. It's not even recognized clinically or officially in hospitals. It's just a new buzzword that's been going around.
I'm just wondering is whether we've been reading all these things, so it's better to be raw, a raw foodist, or whether we're just reading these things and thinking that this might be the next trend, that's the way,
right?
All this material that you can get on Google.
For sure. I mean, raw food is a big thing right now. Mm-hmm. Juicing was the thing last year or the year before.
Mm-hmm.
But these orthorexics is that what that
I
would
think
be
yeah
that,
yes.
right
yeah.
These tend to be people that have from what I understand a real fear of mass-produced food, whether it be because of stuff like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, you know, with the cows, with the problems.
The mad cow disease.
Mad cow disease.
You know, all that kind of stuff, it kind of gets compounded and puts them off, you know, all kinds of foods.
Yeah, so they're scared of processed food, they're scared of chemicals in their food. There was also that contaminated eggs thing that was going around, so they're afraid of that. What happens is they develop a phobia and anxiety, sometimes even depression to do with food. And
because they're not getting their vitamins, that's why.
Yeah, no, there was even this one story of someone who almost went blind because they were not getting a vitamin B12.
Right.
They say the vitamin B12 is not produced by the body naturally, so you need it to come from meats and other like food sources and all. And this person was not getting it. They almost went blind. And the problem was when the doctor told them about this, they said they would rather go blind than go against their beliefs of harming an animal and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when they say that how this problem can be tackled, they say that it can be sort of curbed with cognitive behavioral therapy. So talking about incorrect or excessive beliefs, dealing with anxiety-provoking situations and using relaxation techniques and other methods that actually tackle anxiety, the same things can be used to deal with people who have orthorexia.
Is this thing on the rise?
They say it is. 2-3% of the French population suffer from it. But because
the French,
of
all people,
they
eat everything, and I thought Malaysians ate a lot.
Yeah, I think that's why 2-3% of them suffer from it because they have a good food culture.
Yeah,
right. Mm. So maybe with the amount of food that they consume, so a lot of people sort of jump onto this other bandwagon, like the opposite bandwagon, and go against like their food and stuff.
I'm just thinking, okay, you were talking about just B12. I mean, I'm sure you might be able to get that through a vegetable source as well, but looking at this, it doesn't seem to be the case. Because, I mean, they were explaining a lot of vegetarians, so they must be getting it somewhere.
But most vegetarians, you know, they will subscribe to milk and to cheese and to eggs and,
even
shellfish, right?
I think the one that's difficult is the vegan lifestyle, where there's no eggs, no dairy products, no cheese, no honey, this person said, Sabrina. Stop taking honey because honey apparently comes from bees, which is of organic origin. So even that that's not in the menu anymore. Because there's no reliable data, this condition has not been recognized yet, but it is on the rise. Right now, they've only done a research on the French population, and 2-3% is quite high.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we obviously are not experts on this. What's the phrase we're using?
Orthorexia nervosa.
Right, so we are not experts on this, but I'm sure this is something the bigger picture will cover at some point. You know, when they do, we'll hook up the podcast to that, and you can maybe listen a bit more about it.
Yeah, it'll be also interesting to get people to message
in. I'm very keen. Yeah,
yeah. If they are vegans or vegetarians, like how easy or difficult it is for them to get food or get proper food. Yeah, because I know it's tough. Like sometimes we have like stretches where we need to be like vegetarians. And all, it's very difficult to get good food. It's normally most of the soy products, and the soy products are not healthy. Other than that, no one actually serves proper vegetarian food here locally. It's just easier to get meat.
Yeah. All right, from one story to another, from one kind of punishment, if you like, to a different kind of punishment.
Okay, this is really, really appropriate because this is what happened on Saturday night when I'm sitting down with my son for dinner and I said, Jude, put down your phone. And then he put down this phone. I said, no phone during meals, right? And then we just stared at each other. Okay.
That's just uncomfortable silence.
Context. So anyway, this is a teacher out in the U.S. She did an extreme experiment to get kids turn off their phones. Well, I think this is not something just applicable to teens. She called it the paper, not view. A program. So she's out from Washington, the Washington Latin Public Charter School, and she challenged her 8th and 9th grade students to put down their phones, laptops, tablets, and video game consoles for the 11 Tuesdays of summer.
Okay.
Right. So, and what she did was, whoever did that successfully, confirmed in writing by two adult testimonies, would get $100. So she funded the deal herself, and she did that by, and she canceled her own cable TV service. And of 160 students, 78 attempted the challenge, and 38 succeeded.
Well, that must have almost broke her.
Yeah, so $3,400 poorer.
Oh my word.
But and four students declined the cash, but she felt richer in hope, right? And so what she said was that now they can think more, they know what it feels like now not to have to reach for the phone. And I can understand, right? Because at that stage, I think we're sort of used to it. We've had life before the phone, so we know what other things to do, but they would not have any idea. I think they would have been born with a handphone in their hands, right? So it's also a rare kid who doesn't know on some level that he or she too is too reliant, bordering and addicted. And I think, like I said, you know, it's happening to adults. I mean, do you wake up and look at your phone the first thing in the morning? Because, so there you go, right? So even the adults find it difficult. They use work as an excuse. So the kids can't even role model the parents because I need it for work, which is kind of true.
You see, I'm keeping quite quiet on this because I know how much I rely on my phone.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the things that she got out of it is that first, she hoped to lessen the drama that the girls engage in over the phones. And I know, you know, like you see bullying and everything, all of that happening, the conversations with teenage girls, right? It can get really mean. And the other big concern is sleep, something these students are not getting, right? The boys and girls text each other at 3 and 4 in the morning and they walk in here and they can't function. She did allow for a few exceptions, such as receiving calls from parents or guardians, but call a friend to chat? That was a rare thing. That was a very unusual concept, that you call a phone to talk.
Right.
I mean, I'm thinking about myself, right? Because it's been a while since I picked up a phone to talk to someone.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I think regularly the only person I actually speak with is mum. Right. And that's a FaceTime kind of moment. Mm-hmm. So it's the whole package almost, right. You know. It's a proper conversation. But, you know, to go back to what was being said in here, I know how terribly reliant I am on my phone. And there are times when... you know, even when I'm sat on my own, you know, having lunch or whatever, I'm watching a video or I'm listening to a podcast or I'm doing something else. And it's when you catch yourselves in those moments that, you know, you put your phone down and just people watch for half an hour.
Right.
That is a massive change. It sounds ridiculous, but it really, really helps.
It does. So when I'm sitting out there, no one's sitting there, I'll be reading the paper.
Right.
I'll make a point not to look at the phone. I went on a Facebook fast beginning of this year for about a week and that kind of thing, you know, just say, you know, that's not. So it's really what it's gotten to. So what's happened? She said a lot has happened. They baked and read and hung out with friends.
They did real life things.
They did actual physical things.
So she did say, though, she knew that offering cash for good behavior would raise some eyebrows. Okay, the faculty's mouths were open. Said, "I'm always lecturing them about not bribing the students, but I didn't know what else would work."
Right,
right, and that's a tough one, right? I'm not sure anything else would work. I had to go extreme.
Yeah,
and I'm just thinking, what would incentivize them? You know,
you're right. It's money,
right?
Right.
If there is a better solution, WhatsApp us with a better solution.
Please. WhatsApp us or tweet us.
Tweet us. What. Watch a movie? Is that a good...
I like she did this little thing, though, where she talks about the yes and strategy, where it's yes to technology and fresh air, yes to Snapchat and face-to-face conversations. So you're getting what you want, but you're also limiting yourself in doing it as well.
Right.
So it's that nice balance.
So it's like when my kid now says, "Oh, I've got to meet up with some friends, we're going to discuss a project and everything," and I'm like, good, you know, like you're meeting and you're not just, you know, WhatsApping and chatting, so you're actually meeting. I don't know what they're like when there are three of them together, whether they're all on their phones or actually having a conversation.
Right.
That's another thing. But
lovely stuff. Right, we're going to take a short break, folks. We've got some music coming up from Kiss of all bands. It is Strutter here on Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury in the studio with
Arvind Yuvaraj.
Frida Liu.
So I have a story about smart investing. Now, before I get into this story, this is not advice. I am not giving you advice on how to invest, but I'm going to tell you about this company called Quid AI. You may have heard about them. They are a company. It's a platform that searches, analyzes, and visualizes the world's collective intelligence to help answer strategic questions. For example, stuff like, what is the future of food? What does the public narrative around Airbnb sound like? That kind of stuff. Now, not too long ago, Ira Sager from Business Week had this idea and set a challenge for Quid AI CEO Bob Goodson. He challenged him to program a computer that would predict the next 50 unheard of companies that would make a huge impact.
Huh.
Right? It's a pretty difficult challenge for even the most seasoned of startup analysts. So it's been almost 8 years since that challenge was set, and Business Week decided it was time to review what the machine had done. Somewhat surprisingly, the list is pretty bang on. So amongst the top picks were Evernote, Spotify, Etsy, Zynga, Palantir, Cloudera, and OPower. And these are just the picks familiar to kind of the North American audience.
We know that. I'm on Zynga every day.
Right, yeah. You are indeed, yeah. The bot also managed to select Ibibo, which is the top hotel booking site in India. In 2009, Ibibo only had 8 employees. Now it does more than 2 billion in annual sales.
Who else is on the list?
Right. So, on the back of such success, he reset this challenge. And to begin this new challenge, they found data about investments, received investor profiles, location, and company funding from the S&P. They took 50,000 companies that were selected, and they received venture capital or venture debt and all of this kind of stuff. Put them together and, you know, pushed it to the machine. And said, okay, spit out what you think are going to be some of the better investments over the next couple of years. So I'm going to give you a couple of these brief rundowns. So first off the bat is impact augmented reality. We'll have over virtual reality. So he encourages us to consider that AR, augmented reality, will have more than a huge impact on the general population, and is it more accessible than other VR technologies. Okay. You get it in your phone, you see it quite a lot recently. Snapchat are using it a lot. You don't really need much additional kind of hardware to use it. Next up is noting that image recognition and mapping technologies will be crucial, as they'll have an integral part of the auto industry as traditional cars transition to self-driving vehicles.
Okay.
They also acknowledge the importance of online security. We hammer that into people on a daily basis. Education will also continue to move away from traditional school models towards digital applications, so look for companies that are investing in that. Drones, of course, they come up quite heavily on the list. And finally, wearable technologies that have inbuilt smart sensors are among the top contenders. Products that include stuff like earbuds, eye authentication apps, and holograms.
Right.
So these are all stuff that I think for BizBytes is stuff that we've been talking about quite regularly.
Yeah.
Now, we've been hammering a lot of this stuff. New styles of education, new wearable tech, drones, you know,
self-driving
cars.
But you can really see how much it is a part and parcel of our lives now.
Yeah. But, you know, just to think that these predictions were made by a machine a few years ago, you know, and already they're coming true right now. So the headline of this piece is, one computer is better at investing than experts.
So you got a new list.
That part of the list is coming out sometime in the next couple of weeks. But
a lot of experts are sweating.
Everybody are currently sat here like, you know. But I did a little bit of research into, and I spoke, in fact, with our boss Malik about this, about robo-investing and, you know, a company called Wealthfront. And they're a company that, or rather they're a piece of software, a bunch of algorithms that take ideas of who you might want to invest in, and you give them a specified amount of money. And what it does, it goes off and it builds you a portfolio, irrespective of whether or not you are emotionally involved in it or really think that you might make money. It just uses data to analyze the markets and then predicts it for you. Where there are stuff like where tax is an issue, it looks at places where tax could be lower, invests in that little area during that period, and then when the tax moves, it also moves your money elsewhere. So it's very smart in that respect. It moves your money around all the time. Now, people that I know that have invested in this have said that it's smashed every other investor. So the accountants that have helped them out, it's moved their investments up by the traditional person. Because this person is they have to sleep for a start. You know, machines like this, they don't have to do it.
Predicting. They're on like 24/7.
Yeah, exactly, 24/7. But the idea behind Quid AI, it's a superb project. If you get the chance to check it out, go and have a look at it. It can do all kinds of really interesting stuff. Just, you know, you can...
invest in that.
Invest in that, indeed, yeah. There's going to be some real money in that for sure.
I mean, it makes sense because data, it has its hands in like every single segment and it doesn't forget.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get distracted by anything else. I mean, for the people who say that, you know, data can't work perfectly, I always like to use Waze as an example.
Right.
Yeah, because that's like the simplest way, I mean, the simplest form of data usage.
Yeah.
It's crowdsourced, so people just send in their data, and then Waze uses it to tell you where there's a roadblock or an accident or
right.
which road you should or shouldn't take.
But have you still had that discussion with people who said, no, my way is quicker?
Yeah, all the time.
Right.
All the time.
And you, no matter how you try to prove it to them by, yeah. by showing them, mm-hmm. you know, there's still that pushback, isn't there?
Yeah. I think I took a Grab once a month ago, and then the person picked me up at like a peak hour, like 5 something, and I said, just take the Max because it's easier. And he said, no, I'm going to take some inner roads or something because it's faster. Took me like 1.5 hours to get home.
Wow.
Because he didn't want to use Waze. And if he just followed Waze, he would have taken the Max and I'd be home in like 40 minutes. So Waze knows, because people are giving Waze
right.
information
yeah.
and it
yeah.
knows where's what, and it's not going to give you like wrong information. It's not a person telling you to take this or that way because of their ego or whatever. Like, they know the road to take.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was the thing when I was looking at the kind of Airbnb stuff to kind of look at the data that it collected via social media and Facebook and whatever. And you could just look a few years ago how it was very barely mentioned. And then there was a couple of peaks where certain websites had picked it up and you could see a little bit of money kind of trickling in. And then when that money trickled in, there was another peak. And then more money trickled in, there was another peak.
Yeah.
And you could see all these investors suddenly going, woof, now it's time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So so I'm telling you now, have a look for it. Right, more music. A little bit of Led Zeppelin with Black Dog here on Enterprise Biz Bytes on BFM 89.9.
Audacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes, folks. My name is Rich Bradbury with
Frida Liu,
Arvind Yavaraj.
So we've spoken about orthorexia. We spoke about extreme experiments for kids. That sounds really wrong, but what we mean by that is how to stop your kid from using their phone whilst they're at school.
Ah.
We then spoke a little bit about
it's extreme for them.
It is extreme for it'd be yeah. extreme for anybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like having your third arm taken away.
Yeah.
Smart investing was the next story, and then now Arvind's going to say giving us this story about how smart cities are boring.
Yep,
give us responsive cities.
Yeah. So that's the new term, because they're
this
saying
is the
that
new buzzword. Isn't
the
it?
New buzzword responsive. Because they're saying that, but it's an interesting buzzword.
Okay.
This is a piece that came from TechCrunch, and what they put what the guy wrote was like super interesting, because he's saying that smart cities are old and they're outdated, and what we need are responsive cities. So to become responsive, cities will need to go through 3 phases, which is see, think, and do. So the first one is they need to collect data about their environment, and then number 2, they need to process that data, and finally they need to take real-time action. So he broke it down. Like, so when he said that, what he means by cities need to see, we've been doing this for decades. So you use sensors for everything, your doors, your elevators, your escalators, your traffic lights, street lamps, all of them have sensors. So
pollution sensors, that kind of stuff?
Pollution sensors. So this is how cities see what its population is doing. Then the second step is to think. So that's where the smart city concept comes in, because companies like IBM and GE, what they've been doing is they've been quantifying this data from the C phase, and they've been using it to design new technology and new infrastructure.
Okay.
The problem with this is that by the time they implement these new concepts, the city's people have already evolved and adapted to new technology. So the city is still left in like an older time. It's still behind the time of its population and is not exactly giving the population what they need.
Right.
Yeah. And then the third one is the do. And do is where responsive cities come in.
Right.
Because responsive cities, they respond to the needs, wants, and desires of its citizens, whether they are workers, residents, or visitors. All this is done in real time, and it's active and rich with applications. So
So the future is neon.
It's neon. It's like an app above an app, is what they're saying. It's an app above hardware, above data, and above other base activities. The city by itself works as one big app. One big digital design city. The app will be focused on manipulating infrastructure and influencing behavior to dynamically optimize the city for any number of outcomes, which is safety, convenience, and efficiency, but also for discovery, joy, and community.
Okay, so if I was to cut from what you've just... So I didn't read the article, but what you've just explained to me, the first thing that pops into my head is, for example... a particular city is realizing that there is traffic congestion in one part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what it knows about that traffic, it could then react by rerouting traffic elsewhere.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, because they see
it's called Waze, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Waze.
Right?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest ones. If they can tap into Waze and what Waze knows, and they can design the city around Waze's data, that's what a responsive city is.
This is it's just a simple idea.
Yeah. But what to make it work, they need infrastructure and concepts that actually change with the app. So you need the whole city to work as one big, basically a living organism by itself.
Right.
That works based on data. They say the problem is, you know, you have to wonder if we have the resources. So for this to work, you need digital controllable infrastructures. So Uber and Lyft are some of the examples of how this works, because Uber and Lyft, they keep changing their system and their structure depending on what people need. They don't just keep giving people services that they don't want. You need digital screens and dynamic street furniture. Those are also happening in some cities. So those are responsive infrastructure. These products superimpose real-time information over the city to inform or influence the population. So like changing billboards, like LED billboards are examples of responsive infrastructure. Then you need to also use automation and machine learning to predict and respond to the demands of millions of people at once.
I'll give you another example. There's in Tokyo, some of the buildings, when you're coming down the elevator, if it's raining outside, a little thing pops up with an umbrella saying, you're going to need your umbrella when you get outside.
Really simple.
But, you know.
And even now, the stuff that we use, the DBKL boards, if it's if it tells you in like the Sungai Besi Highway that Tun Razak is going to be congested.
When is it not?
But it's the simplest form of responsive design.
I would like one that says, there's a pothole here. Can we fix it now?
Again, Waze. Waze gives you the pothole stuff.
Yeah.
If Waze can send that data to the council and the council can do it immediately, that's responsive.
I mean, this is all wonderful ideas, though, but this is kind of... It goes back to the idea of the city council, you know, wanting to have a city that's smart and responsive, and because it will be an awful lot of investment in infrastructure to do something like this.
Yeah, they actually broke it down into like three major steps that cities have to take for them to become responsive. So they have to stop thinking about what is possible and they have to start with the desired outcomes. So don't think about what they can build, think about if they need to build it first. And then go ahead. So city managers need to identify untapped resources or infrastructure and then make it easy to partner and collaborate with the private sector. So the private sector has to play like a big part in this. So like the GEs and the IBMs and stuff, they have to lend their technology to the city to make sure that the city can become fully responsive to its people.
I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing this in Puerto Rico. I mean, we were speaking about it last week, about how Tesla are over there, Google are over there, Facebook have been over there. You know, this could be like a test bench area for them.
Yeah. And no, if Tesla has their power, what do they call them?
The power bank.
Yeah, the power bank. If they have those installed in every city and then you have like a hurricane or something that knocks out the power and then the power banks kick in, that's responsive as well.
Right.
So the city's going, it's doing what the population needs it to do. It's not just housing and structure. They say that you also have to understand groups of people and influence their behaviors. So basically, a responsive city is reflective of the humans in it. So this should open up like an interesting study of what the people in the city are like, whether they need certain things, and then the city sort of adapts to it. So dynamic road closures for on-demand pedestrian plazas, directing people with different mobility needs to the fastest route to an event, or helping them discover a new business that just opened, basically balancing people's needs with the city's facilities in real time. And the third big one is it has to be in real time, like I mentioned. So if something is happening today, the city has to change to it today. It cannot happen like next week or next month when people don't need it anymore.
And therein lies the challenge.
Right. The problem.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first thing that popped into my head was something like, let's say, for example, people wanted to have a rally or something like that. You know, the amount of planning that goes into something like that, you know, and everybody that has to get involved, you know, an immediate response to that, you know, roads closed, traffic being diverted, boom.
And if people go according to this, the architecture of cities itself will change.
Drastically.
Because you'll have to make buildings that can actually change to accommodate different kinds of situations. He ended it by saying that the focus should not be only staying relevant for years and as cities change on the macro scale, but staying relevant from moment to moment, from the morning commute to lunch.
So this is one of those things where we're going to have to see new cities being built.
Yeah. New buildings, new roads, or maybe they can start off by just telling people like which way to take on the way to work and which road is not jammed, which is impossible in KL because any road they take is going to be the same in the morning.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a start.
All right. Time for a short break. Music coming up. It is Black Rebel Motorcycle Club with the track Stop. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9.
Welcome back, folks, to Enterprise Biz Bytes. Almost time for us to wrap up for the day. But before we do, some events that you might want to check out this week, starting with Malaysia's Startup Investors Forum.
Okay, that's happening tomorrow from 12:30 to 4 p.m. This is at the VIA Hotel in Bangsa South. You can join investors, VCs, fund managers, institutional investors, entrepreneurs, and others to listen to their advice on best practices, how to identify the next unicorn, risk mitigation, success factors, and what they're looking for in the teams to invest in. So the topics covered will include how to spot the next trend. It's called Quit AI. I'm just kidding. investing in products versus people, challenges and opportunities for the startups, emerging trends in Asia versus startup investing. I mean, this startup talk is always a buzz, so it'd be great if you can make it there. It's free, so just go and look up Startup Investors Forum 2017 on eventbrite.com if you're interested.
Yeah. Then we also have the Brandker Innovation number 4. This time they're talking about disruptive branding and business model. That's happening on Thursday, October 19th at H-Space in Bandar Utama. So in this Brandker Innovation number 4, you will learn how to create a disruptive business model. So which areas in your business can you innovate to achieve growth and gain new customers? What is branding beyond just a logo and design, and how you can make your brand disruptive in order to stand out from the competition? The Brandker Innovation Series is all about debunking branding myths and introducing innovative perspectives on enhancing your business model. So they've listed who should attend. It's basically entrepreneurs, CEOs, head of strategy, business development managers, SME business owners, so like a wide range of people. Matthew Chong will be the speaker. He's an international branding and business coach. He's also the founder of Malaysia's fastest growing local coffee chain, Kosan's Coffee. I think there's one in Bangsa. I've seen an outlet there. Tickets are free, so for more information, you can WhatsApp Celine at 016-782-20878 or visit ptix.com.
All right, and finally is an event called Bitcoin, Fad, Bubble, or Scam. That's happening on Saturday on October the 21st from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. It's at Noesis KL at Sunway Velocity. The speaker is Chongjin Yong. He is a CFA. So this workshop provides participants with a solid understanding of cryptocurrencies, of which Bitcoin is just one, albeit the most famous of all. Additional topics include ICOs, which are initial coin offerings. Cryptocurrency trading, data privacy, and regulatory issues are also to be introduced and spoken about. Tickets are 150 ringgit if you want to attend, or 90 ringgit just for the video conference option. To know a little bit more about the options and how to participate, check out ptix.com. That's all we've got time for today, but before we do that, we'll quickly run through the stories that we covered today. Arvin, what did you start off with?
Yeah, we spoke about orthorexia, which is when people obsess over their diets and then they endanger their health in the process.
All right, and this is a US principal trying to get kids to lay down their phones, laptops, tablets and video game consoles so they can experience life.
I spoke a little bit about Quid AI, about how it predicted some of the startups you should have invested in a few years ago and how it's now giving you some new options. You might want to listen to the podcast a little bit later on to get yourself some advice.
Then we also spoke about responsive cities and how smart cities are old and outdated, and we need to move into cities that respond to its population and what they need.
That's it then. So don't go anywhere though, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay with Dato Joyce Yap, CEO of Pavilion, Sindari Mahad. So the retail industry has been hit hard this year by weakening consumer sentiment, and the growth of e-commerce is continuing to impact brick-and-mortar retail players. Is there a future for shopping malls? The Breakfast Grill spoke with Dato Joyce Yap, who is the CEO of Pavilion, on how the company is navigating the challenging retail scene and the shift in shopping trends in Malaysia. That's all coming up after the 1 o'clock news at 1 o'clock. So on behalf of Arvin Yuvaraj and, of course, Frida Liu, I'm Rich Bradbury, and we'll be back again tomorrow, same time, same place, for Enterprise Biz Bytes here on BFM 89.9.